Welcome back to Romance Ever After, the podcast where we talk about romantic comedies exclusively with the romance novel loving community. I'm Allie Parker, and today I'm super excited about my guest, Nicole Perkins. Nicole is a writer from Nashville, Tennessee, currently based in Brooklyn. Around the internet, Nicole writes about the intersections of pop culture, race, sex, gender, and relationships. Nicole was a co-host of the popular podcast Thirst Aid Kit, which covers pop culture and desire. She is also one of the hosts of The Waves, a podcast that examines news and culture through a feminist lens. Both podcasts are at Slate. Her first collection of poetry, Lilith But Dark, was published by Publishing Genius in July 2018. And her memoir, Sometimes I Trip on How Happy We Could Be, will be coming soon from Grand Central Publishing. It will cover Black womanhood and sexuality, online message board communities, and the effects of pop culture on female desire. Nicole loves prints, romance novels, and the television show Frasier. Please welcome Nicole.
Hi. Thanks so much for asking me to be on the show. I'm so excited to talk about rom-coms and the movie that we're going to talk about in particular. It's one of my favorites. I'm excited.
I'm excited too. I actually have the movie we're talking about. I actually haven't seen in forever. So when you brought it, I was like, yeah, let's do that one. That should be fun. Before we get into today's movie though, let's talk about you in romantic comedies. Like, okay. Everybody who I talked to, they love romantic comedy so far. So I'm assuming the same is for you. Let's talk about your journey, how you got there.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I do love rom-coms. And it's funny because there's this moment in the 90s where rom-coms are very popular and they all start the same two or three different women. And some of those women I did not care for. So like if there is a rom-com that stars Julia Roberts, I probably have not seen it. So when people are always like, oh, Pretty Woman, I'm just like, sure, I guess. I don't know. Cause I refuse to watch it. I am a child of the 80s and I was a teenager in the 90s. So it was like prime rom-com years. My favorite of all time is When Harry Met Sally. It's just an awesome movie. And, you know, we've talked about this before on my show, Thirst Aid Kit, but it turns out that once you like actually examine rom-coms, they're actually pretty chaste, you know? Yeah. There's not like, you know, maybe there is, you know, a moment off scene where they get together and have sex. And then, you know, the rest is like the goofy part of getting back together. Or there's a few kisses or something like that. And it's just, I bring that up because it's interesting to me because I typically like to see steamy stuff. Oh, yeah. I want to see the steamy stuff. I love romance novels that have the steamy stuff in it. Mm-hmm. So for me to be a dedicated rom-com fan, I mean, it tracks, but it's also a little unusual.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that, you know, people don't really have sex on screen a lot in romantic comedies, because I feel like though there was kind of a moment in time, either like in the early 90s, late 80s, where there was a little bit more sex on screen than there was, but especially as you get like later in the 90s, like the sex is just gone. If you're lucky, if you get any kisses whatsoever, especially by the time you get to the 2000s, like when rom-coms were dying out completely, for as horny as we are as a society, like it just seemed to just completely get sucked out of romantic comedies in general.
Yeah, you know, and I think part of that was I don't know, I think it was a little sexist because a lot of rom-coms in the 2000s, when it started to fade, I think they were fading because it was just the same story of, oh, here's this clumsy woman who, you know, she's so goofy and clumsy, she doesn't deserve love. Or here's a woman who is super uptight and she ends up with this, you know, awful guy who is not worthy of her, but look how her life has changed, you know? So I feel like a lot of them depicted women in very unflattering ways. And I think that's part of why they fell off. And also, you know, there were a lot of men writing rom-coms. Oh, and I think that was very, very much a part also of why they kind of fell off and became less about the physical intimacy between people, because quite frankly, men, for the most part, at least straight men, don't know how to write good sex scenes, good intimacy scenes, you know, and it just kind of fell apart for a little bit.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because I've been thinking about this a lot because Timothy Oliphant has just popped up in everybody's radar and everybody's been talking about Catch and Release a lot and the sexual tension in that. So Susanna Grant, who wrote that and she directed it too, she has like these really great chemistry and like sex scenes. And there's a lot of sex in it for a romantic comedy that came out in 2006. Like there's a lot of desire and sex and wanting in that. And then I think about Cats and Dogs, which is from in the 90s, and that was written by a woman too. And that one has like the great phone sex scene, which it's not about his desire at all. It's really all just about her and her getting off, which totally flew over my head when I was a kid and I saw that. But yeah, but I feel like women write the better sex scenes in romantic comedies, and they actually care
Yeah,
about
I do
it.
too.
Okay, but for moving on from that, let's talk about tropes, which I believe are the engines of romantic comedies, as are they are romance novels. Which do you like? And does it matter if you're looking at it on screen versus reading it, or even personally writing it yourself?
So I think I'd rather read the, oh no, there's only one bed trope in a novel as opposed to seeing it on screen. Because I think when you see it, I don't know, it gets kind of, I don't know, a little weird and maybe a bit more, I think there's a bit more pressure like between like our expectations of what's going to happen. I mean, it can still work, but I think I prefer to read it in a romance novel. I love the trope where, a woman comes back to her small hometown that's filled with quirky characters, and she realizes that her high school love or her college love is still there, and they end up reconnecting and like getting back together. I love that one. I do love a good, we're on the run, like if it's like a thriller or some kind of like heist kind of romance thing happening, and they end up like stuck in a cabin someplace by
Then
themselves.
they danger bang.
Yes, I love all of that. And I think, well, the one that we're gonna end up talking about with this movie is the one where there's like, oh, we had a one night stand. We thought it was just gonna be that one night stand, and then, oh no, we reconnect, and it's kind of, we don't want to, but we realize that there's something there, and maybe the something there is a baby, or maybe the something there is just, two people fated to be together. But I love a good, we just thought this was a fling, and now it's something more. I love that.
Yeah, I like that one too. I think for me, I find it's really done really well in movies. Like I feel like you see that one more in books and it's done well, but in movies it's a lot harder to do. I don't know, but I think this one pulls it off pretty well, considering all the obstacles that they have going on. So with that in mind, let's jump into today's movie, which we will be talking about Fools Rush In. Starring Selma Hayek and Matthew Perry from 1997. So fun fact about this movie, it's actually based on a true story. One of the producers on the movie, and I guess the woman as well, his ex-wife at the time, actually, this is actually based on their life. She is half Mexican and half German, and he was an uptight dude from, I guess, the East Coast who moved out to LA, and they met while he was on vacation in Southern California at one point. And so the distance wasn't as great for them as it was for these two characters, but it became kind of a really quirky situation of how do we juggle our lives, and what do? We come from two very different kinds of cultures, and bringing their lives together. And so that's actually the story that this movie's born out of. However, by the time that they were actually producing it, they were divorced, and
I didn't know that.
it was very difficult for them to watch the movie every day as it was happening, because basically it was their lives, and I think they had been divorced like maybe a year by the time it got to screen. So it was really awkward for them. But let's actually get into this movie. So it starts out where we see Matthew Perry's character, Alex Whitman. He's in New York. It's cold. it's winter, you know, it's as far as possible from life on in the Southwest as you can get. And, you know, he's going to work and he's practicing his Japanese because he thinks he's going to be going to Tokyo pretty soon for a job. Alex is an architect of some kind. I still haven't figured out what kind of architect he is.
Yeah, like nightclubs and like stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, he builds nightclubs, but like he also helps to see them through all the way. Like I've never seen an architect who's also picking out the menu and hiring bartenders. Like typically they just tend to stick with designing the joint and bouncing. But I guess this is a full service kind of company.
Maybe he's like, I guess it's a project manager. I don't know exactly what that would be, but yeah, he's really super involved in everything.
Everything. So he's supposed to be going to Japan, but he finds out he's getting sent to Las Vegas for a club out there, which is the furthest thing that he would possibly want. But he knows that if he goes to do it, he'll get to come back to New York to his dream project. So he's like, okay, I'll do this. I'll go. On the other side, we meet Isabel Fuentes, who is a photographer. She works as, you know, just kind of a floor camera person at Caesars, but, you know, she has her whole life and family either in and around Las Vegas, or she has her great grandmother who is down in central Mexico that she's very close with. So she goes down there a lot, driving back and forth across Nevada state lines, which comes into play. We see her first time where when she's crossing over the Hoover Dam, she always makes a point to toss a silver dollar as her own personal wish. And it's her own personal ethos because we'll find out later that her great grandfather helped to build it. These are our lovers, two very disparate people from very different backgrounds whose lives are about to collide because of fate. So Alex is in Vegas and he's trying to go steal, I guess, a chef from a Mexican restaurant that's owned by a family. And he's hanging out at this roadside place, completely like the only white guy there. And Isabel, who's just, I guess, come back from seeing her great grandmother, stops here because she, number one, has to pee. But also, since she's stuck in line, she's decided that she's going to rehearse her breakup speech with her current boyfriend, Chewy, who is a cop somewhere around the, I guess, Clark County. And, you know, as she's there waiting in line, she realizes that the line got super long. So she basically flirts with Alex to get a spot in line. And they have like kind of this really cute back and forth. And Alex is clearly mesmerized by her and her ridiculous logic. It's Selma Hayek. How can you not? Right.
And he does this very like, I know it's also kind of there to illustrate their cultural differences, but he also does this very white person thing of asking her, you know, he overhears our conversation where she's talking about signs and, you know, there was a sign for her to break up with Chewy. And he's like, so that whole thing about signs, is that a religious thing or a cultural thing? And then Isabel kind of breaks it down for him. But it's just kind of like, why does it, I mean, yes, they are cultural things, you know, like, you know, this belief in signs from angels or God or whomever, but it's also just kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like the equivalent of somebody walking up to me and being like, oh, is that the way Black girls do their hair? You know, I don't know. It's just like, it's just like a weird kind of thing. And again, I know it's to highlight their cultural differences and to show that Alex does not believe in signs. He does not believe in fate. He does not believe in any of that stuff. He thinks it's just superstitious nonsense. Whereas Isabel is very much into being attuned to the spirits and God and all the stuff that comes along with that. And, you know, it's a nice way to show their differences, but also it's just kind of like, oh gosh, what do you, you know, and also, you know, you know, his last name is Whitman. And I always wondered if they had originally called him White Man and then just like Alex White Man and then just took out the E to make it more palatable. I don't know, but it always struck me that that was his name.
Yeah. I think I'm willing to bet that it actually was like on purpose, because apparently like at one point they had like tried more dramatic versions of the screenplay, and then eventually they settled on comedy, and this was probably like, hey, how can we make this any funnier? And they went with literally calling him Alex White Man. So after, we see these two have total fireworks. And Isabel ducks into the bathroom. Our very next scene, we see her waking up in his bed.
Right.
Clearly, they had a night because clothes are everywhere. And just, it's early in the morning and she's sneaking out. And, Alex is left to wonder if he'll ever see her again. And then, fast forward. 3 months later, Alex is still working at the site, and this is when we get our first appearance of Kathy, the family friend, who is so waspy Connecticut white girl. It's like, why are you in Vegas
Right.
still like this?
Yes.
Like, I would get like if she was out there momentarily, but apparently she flies back and forth all the time, and she has maintained like the super Connecticut mom appearance, but he's apparently been avoiding her since third grade. Clearly their family has always tried to get them together, and Alex is just wants none of that. So Alex is supposed to be having dinner with his friend who is also working at the site and the county commissioner's wife to try and smooth over some things for the building permits. The commissioner's wife clearly wants to fuck Alex and only Alex. And his friend is really ready to sell him, like just sell his body
Yes.
for all the permits. And his friend is played by John Tenney, which is really funny because I feel like later on in John Tenney's career, he's gotten kind of a rap of being a nice guy. But back then, he was always like the smarmy douchebag. And it was really nice to see him be that again. And so while Alex is about to basically be pounced on by this woman, there's somebody who comes to the door, and it just so happens to be Isabel, who needs to talk to Alex about some things that happened 3 months ago. And Alex is just so excited to see her because, she snuck out and Alex really liked her and wanted to find her and maybe go out on some more dates. But Isabel is there to tell him she's pregnant. And it's this really great scene because, he was going to be giving her some water, and she was like, I'm pregnant. And he's like, oh, thinking like, oh, I can't date her because she has a fiance. So he starts drinking it himself. And when she says it's yours, he's just frozen in the motion, just gulping it down. And this is like the height of Friends, so he is excessively Chandler Bing in this
Yeah.
whole movie.
Yeah. It was really, it's a really fun moment. And also, I wondered if there, I can't remember the time and I should have looked this up, but later in Friends, when Ross and Rachel, when Rachel ends up pregnant by Ross is like, but we use condoms, their jobs are to is to work. Why didn't they work? And that kind of thing. And this is also what Alex's character says in this moment when Isabel tells him that she's pregnant. He was like, I used condoms, lots of them. And she was like, well, one of them didn't work. And I think, in this trope of we had a one night stand and I ended up accidentally pregnant, that was like the trope that I first that introduced me to romance novels when I first started reading them when I was very little, when like in the 80s. But once, like, time progressed and we became more focused on safe sex and being, using protection and things like that, and people tried to still work that trope into romance stories, it became, oh, yes, we use condoms, but one of them broke or one of them didn't work, or we were that 1% that failure rate or whatever. So I'm always fascinated by the ways that, as time progressed, as we became more modernized in our thinking about relationships, how romance stories still kind of worked that element in. But I love that. I love that scene where he just keeps drinking the water. He is so funny. And, you know, this was like you said, it was a height of Friends. I don't think overall that the movie got the reception that it wanted. And I think it's become a little bit of a cult favorite when it comes to rom-coms. But I really like Matthew Perry as, you know, this rom-com lead. And I think, you know, he could have had more of a career in that if things had worked differently.
Yeah, I like around this time he did actually have a couple of rom-coms that he did. And it's really funny how, because he is kind of charming. He is kind of charming in like kind of more of that Woody Allen kind of manner of things, but he is charming and he would make such a great rom-com lead, but I don't think that any of his movies did really well, unfortunately. And but on like when you look at them now, they're actually not that bad. So there's what that movie, Three to Tango, I think that he
Yeah,
did.
with Bruce Willis.
No, that's a whole nine yards. Three to
Oh.
Tango, it's him, Neve Campbell, and I can't remember the other guy's name, but he's his the sleazy guy's friend or something, and he pretends to be gay, which is kind of a really gross trope. But I remember at the time the movie wasn't that bad to watch. But it just didn't do well. And the only comedy that had some romance that did sort of well with it for him was Whole Nine Yards.
He was good in 13 Again with Zac Efron, which I
Yeah.
really like that. I don't know if that's considered a rom-com, but I really liked that movie. I think yeah, I like Matthew Perry as a rom-com lead. 'Cause even though he is not like the overly handsome kind of guy that we see more often now in rom-coms, he does have that charm that you were talking about. And you see that in Fools Rush In, where he charms Isabel with his like there are mom these moments where he is super vulnerable and super open with her, and you can see that that's what she's falling for, like those open moments. And it's later when he starts to shut her out and like close down and not be open that
Yes.
that's when they start to have the problems.
Yeah. Okay, so let's keep going though. So he finds out that she's pregnant and you know, he still has this county commissioner lady who wants to jump his bones. But you know, he's supposed to be going to dinner with them, but he ends up deciding to run out after Isabel, and he literally chases her down the highway, almost causes a collision at one point, and he follows her to what is her spot at the Hoover Dam. She has this little overlook that she likes to sit at and go think. And he catches up with her there, and he's like, you know, I want to make this right. Is there anything I can do? I want to help you, even though, you know, we're not together. Let me just be do something, like kind of be a part of helping you in your situation. And she agrees that one thing that he can do is come with her to her weekly family dinner. And you know, so that she can say just once that, you know, you've met the guy who was the father, and that'll be enough. That's all you have to do. And so they go to this really great, boisterous, just like basically a party. But that's their weekly family dinner. But I really love that when they're getting to the house, her brother is coming out. And he got sent on a run to the store for something. And he's like, and to think I was gonna leave.
He's so excited to see like their parents' reaction to Isabel bringing home this white boy, and not just a white guy, but he's like in a shirt and tie, just very buttoned up and everything, while everybody else, you know, is loose and, you know, casual and also everything opposite of him.
I was like, but here's the thing though, in Alex's defense, he was technically at a business meeting
True,
when
true.
he chased after Isabel, but he came in literally the worst possible clothes for this event to like introduce himself casually. But you know, of course, they go into dinner and the music stops and everybody's staring at them. And she's like, what? I can't bring home a boyfriend for dinner? Starts introducing him around. It's very clear he's out of his element, but everybody's being very welcoming to him. And he's trying to put into play all the information Isabel Belle gave about her family without screwing up. But of course he's screwing up. And he has this really great moment where one of her cousins just hands over her baby girl. And he's stuck there with this little baby. And he's holding her and she's cuddling him. And he's getting high off of that baby smell. And he's watching Isabel walk around and be all family oriented. And he's just got this look on his face that he realizes he's never really had this and he likes it and he wants to be a part of it. And I get it, because you hold a baby and you smell a baby and you just want that in your life constantly. So, you know, after dinner's over and he's helping clean up, he actually grabs her and he kisses Isabel really deeply and passionately. And they have that moment like, whoa, what is happening here? We still have some chemistry. And as they're driving back, it's like, well, maybe we could give it a go of something. I don't know. And he just goes, fuck it all to hell. I want to marry you. And he convinces her. And then they go and they rush off and they get married by Elvis.
Yes, yes. And he says this line and it's delivered. It's supposed to be funny, right? It's supposed to show how confused he is. But he says, you are everything I never knew I always wanted. And I think that that is perfect, because sometimes you really don't know what you want. You don't know what you've been looking for until it is presented to you. So it is, I love that line. And when I remember when this movie came out, I was a junior in college and I was working at Blockbuster Video. So I could get like free movies, so many free movies a week to rent. And I rented it and my boyfriend and I were watching it. And when I saw that part, I was just like, oh my God. And I just had this like, I didn't cry or anything, but it was just a really emotional moment of, you know, like, are you going to say this when you supposed to be, you know, putting all this pressure on him? And obviously we are not together, that didn't last past college, but it was just like this really, really sweet moment. And I don't know, I love that. And I love that he, you know, chased after her, which is also this, you know, an important part of rom-coms, right? There's always somebody who's like, they have this epiphany and you have to chase after somebody, and we get that you know, actually more than once, but we'll get to that a little later.
So, you know, they get married. We have a lovely montage of their wedding scene and their night after. Yeah. More sexy fun times that are mostly happen off screen. And so then they go on with they move in together and decide to go on with their lives. So we have this great moment where he's at the work site and Isabel is trying to call him. He's too busy to take her call, but he tells his assistant to tell her he'll call her back and to get her number.
Right.
Because he still doesn't have it. And she's like, it's an emergency. It's an emergency. And we never get to talk to Isabel because 2 seconds later, Isabel's dad pulls up.
Yeah.
And he's got a baseball bat and he is about ready to beat Alex's ass. He's like, you know, you come into my house, you disrespect me, you marry my daughter without, you know, not being in the church, without my consent, which, yes, gross that he thinks he owns his daughter, basically. But also he has every right to be pissed off. You know, he met him and then 2 seconds later they went and got married, you know, without saying anything to him. They're heavily Catholic. The fact that, you know, he didn't marry her in a church is a big, big no-no.
Right.
And so we get dinner afterward with her friend and Alex's friend. And, you know, Isabel is saying that her dad has disowned her. Her mother has called her a sinner and all this other shit. And they start talking about where they're going to live. And her friend has this great line about how a lot of this shit would have come up on the second date.
Yes.
Because both Alex and Isabel don't realize that Alex really lives in New York. And Alex is just assuming that Isabel's going to move to New York with them. And Isabel's like, my whole fucking life is here. I just like invested a whole bunch of money in camera equipment for a book that I'm going to do, which I'm sure she hasn't told Alex about either. Because all they've done so far is fucking get married. So it's just like this shell shock about what their lives are. And Isabel's like, well, what did your parents say? And he said, you know, my parents are in Europe for the summer in April because he's a fucking liar. He hasn't told his parents at all. But Isabel's family comes out and paints their whole house, and she decorates his whole house, which at that point had just been as plain and white and bare as possible.
Right, because it was just corporate housing. He didn't want to stay at a hotel because he was like, it would be too many distractions. And so he's just in like this basic suburban, you know, community, and they come and they add some flavor to it.
Big time. And I think it's really a really great callback, because when Isabel comes to tell Alex that she's pregnant, she's standing outside, and John Tinney answers the door, so she's confused, and she pulls back to look up, thinking that she got the wrong house, because every house looks exactly the fucking same. But her family comes in and they paint the exterior, so like it stands out, it has life, it has flavor. And you know, he just realizes now that that party he saw a week, 2 weeks ago, it's not just going to stay at her parents' house. It's also going to be a part of his life now.
Right,
too.
Right. He's definitely experiencing some culture shock. And like, there's then this montage of them living together, which was really great. And it's like the domestic bliss part of their relationship. And the thing that struck me as I gotten older and rewatched it is that in this montage, we see Alex at work and Alex at home, but you know, he's working all this like on his job. I mean, and then when they're at home, we see Isabella, we see Isabel, she's like doing laundry while she's also doing her darkroom stuff with her photography, or she's cooking. So she definitely has these more domestic chores that she's doing. And Alex is just kind of mesmerized because he watches her dancing one time while she's cooking, and he, you can see him falling in love again, but like, you know, he sees more of her spirit and more of who she is and more of her personality, and he is so completely taken by her.
And one thing I did like about this is that it didn't become, oh, well, you're pregnant and we're going to get married and you're just going to be my stay-at-home wife. Like, she kept her job. She kept her priorities in her life, her, the book that she's working on, the pictures that she takes in her private time. She's still doing that. That's why she turned their laundry room into a dark room as well. Like, that still was a main part of her. And I, cause I get the sense that Alice could probably afford to just take care of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, I would, honestly, he probably could have moved to Las Vegas and worked from there remotely or something, but you know, that's fine.
But yeah, so like, I do appreciate that Isabel keeps her life. She's just bringing her life to where Alex is as well. And she's hoping that Alex will do the same to her. But I also get the sense that Alex is actually pretty insular too, because like, you know, he says he doesn't really spend time with his parents. He only sees them at holidays. His only friend that we really see is this John Tinney character, who is a lawyer for the same firm that he works for. So it doesn't seem like he has like much outside of his life besides work. And now he's now Isabel is in his life, and she's bringing more than just work. She's bringing family, she's bringing community, she's bringing this passion for the signs of the universe and fate that she believes in. And he's mesmerized by it, and he's into her, but he hasn't really completely bought in on the whole lifestyle change just yet.
Right. You mentioned he only sees his parents like for the holidays, and he talks about how even that, the conversation is stilted. They don't really talk when, you know, they're together. And Isabel, when we see in that domestic bliss montage, she's the type of person that she's going to be peeing on the toilet, and she wants you sitting right there in front of her while she talks to you. And he is just like, whoa, I do not want to be here. You're using the bathroom. You know, so she just has this really vivid openness that he is not fully prepared for. And he's trying, obviously, because he like, he sits there while she's talking to him on the toilet, but it's still just like, he's very uncomfortable with it. I love that.
And so after the montage of happy bliss, they have this night where he takes her to his work site so he can see what she does. So she can see what he does. And they have dinner there, and they're both kind of talking about where they're both from. She's talking about like all of like the open spaces of Mexico and Nevada and like all the prettiness there. And he's talking about New York life and sitting at the Bethesda Fountain, and you could like see the whole city walk by. And, you know, he's trying to convince her that New York is cool too. It's not just Las Vegas and Nevada. And she says this great scene, like, and I know this canyon that you can go to that's so far away from everywhere, and you can sit there long enough that you can die and no one will ever find you. Because she is pissed about him talking about New York, because she wants him to stay. And because she's still pissed, she sends him off to go shooting with her brothers and her ex-boyfriend for the day.
Yes, yes. I love this scene so much.
And he's trying so hard. He's trying so hard to like get along with the guys who barely know him and barely trust him. Mm-hmm. Because he's basically this white guy who just swooped in and stole their baby sister and, you know, ex-girlfriend. And here he is. I guess we're going to take about out someplace that he's not used to. And he's, you know, trying to talk to everybody and be friendly. And he falls into literally a pit of rattlesnakes. Mm-hmm. And they realize and they come over and they're just like, don't move. And they all shoot at him at once. And he starts dancing. And the next time we see him, he's got a backside full of cactus needles. Yes. And he's drunk off his ass because they only had for the pain was tequila. Isabel, on the other side of things, is having lunch with one of her friends, I guess in a hotel somewhere, and she runs into Kathy, who's like, did I hear you say Alex Whitman? And she's like, yes. Oh, you know Alex? And, you know, they start chatting, and she's like, well, how do you know Alex? She's like, oh, we're married. And she's pregnant. And Kathy's like, oh, really? Is that so? Is that why he's been avoiding me all these months? Mm-hmm. So the very next scene after Alex has, you know, been shot at, has a backside full of cactus needles, we see him wandering around the house with the donut while Isabella is furiously cleaning because nesting and pregnant. Mm-hmm. And you get a visitor who just so happens to be Alex's parents. And Alex is freaked out because Alex still has not told his parents that, number one, he's married, let alone having a baby too. Mm-hmm. And his parents do that oh so classist white person thing of thinking that Isabel, who's running around, is cleaning the house, is his housekeeper.
Right.
And he, before he even gets a chance to say anything to them, Isabel opens the door, and he's trying to figure out how to introduce her, but before he even gets a chance, you know, Isabel is just sweeping them into the house and trying to give him, you know, drinks or whatever. And she realizes fairly quickly thereafter that Alex still has not told them that he is married to her. And she lets him have it in a torrent of Spanish. One of the things I do like about this movie is the majority of the Spanish, they do not subtitle. Mm-hmm. Like, you just either have to figure it out with context clues or figure it out later, because mm-hmm. they're not going to tell you. Mm-hmm. But Selma Hayek just lets him have it, storms off, and he runs after her. And his dad turns to his mom and says, somebody's getting fired. Like, oh, no, 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 no. And then after she lets him have it, he comes back downstairs and he introduces her, and his parents are floored. And then we have the great meeting of the parents at...
Yes, yes. And it's like... So a fun fact, that's actually Matthew Perry's father in real life. That's
playing. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's his real dad. But yeah, so it's really interesting to see Alex's parents meet Isabel's parents, because again, like, they're that WASP versus Mexican Catholic culture fight that happens. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very interesting to watch. And you know, Alex, he slowly realizes when he's, you know, since his parents showed up, he realizes how terrible some of their views are, you know, and the things that they say about, like, his mom was like, oh, you must have really good help available here since you're so close to Mexico and all. And he looks at her like, what are you talking about? But when they get together on that boat and Isabel's parents are trying to tell them, hey, you need to have like some sunblock and all this, you know, because the sun is really bright. And Alex's parents are like, oh, no, we'll be fine. We're undercover. And, you know, so Alex, Isabel's parents are like, okay, like, they know what they're talking about. They live in this city. They know this area. They know you should trust them, but they don't. Mm-hmm. And you also get this picture of Alex's mom as this kind of, I guess, a wine mom, you know, because she's...
Oh, yeah. She's getting drunk off margaritas.
Yes, she's been a little tipsy. And even, like, back at the house when Alex tells them that Isabel is his wife, she has a beer bottle that Isabel had given her, and she just drinks from the beer bottle. She's like, oh, Lord, you know, it's just... she is definitely a white suburban wine mom.
Yeah, and she's, like, steadily getting loaded the whole entire time, mm-hmm. which kind of leads to this a dichotomy of we have the fathers who are very realist about the whole situation, and then the mothers who are more so falling into the romanticism of it all. Like, you know, right. It's very romantic, it's fate, you know, the heart wants what it wants, even though Alex's mom is like three sheets to the wind. She too is like, you know, saying, eh, it's okay, my son is in love, this is what happens. Maybe drinking is just her way of processing everything. I don't know, but like she's a little bit more chill about the situation than the father is. However, when we get to the discussion about religion for the child, that's when both moms kind of get back into the attack mode with the fathers, because Isabel's family obviously assumed the kid's going to be raised Catholic. Mm-hmm. Alex's family wants the kid to be raised Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. And it's just a fighting of words and culture. And, you know, Alex's dad says something about, what do you call cultured, like guacamole and ghetto blasters?
Yes. Oh, man.
And I was like, what, number one, you know the term ghetto blaster? But come on, like, are you kidding me? Like, to be that rude to these people who are trying to be nice to you, and two, this is not your decision at all whatsoever. These two have to decide what religion the child's going to be. Like, come on. But the dad is also right. It typically does fall to the mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because she's going to be the one who's hauling the kids to church. Alex ain't going to do it.
Right.
So after that, Isabel, that's right. The dad says something about the white people are melting out.
Yes, yes. Like, the scene ends and he's like, Tomas, like, he doesn't even want to call Isabel's father Tomas, he wants to say Thomas. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, Thomas, whatever. And he's like, the white people are melting. And it's just like, oh, it's like a big record scratch for the moment. And that's like, okay, that's the end of it. And then the next thing you know, we see them like going to their hotel, and Alex's parents are beet red because they have been burnt to a crisp in the sun, because they would not listen when they told them, put on sunblock because the sun is going to bounce off the water and it's going to hit you. They would not listen. So now they're in so much pain.
Mm-hmm. Like, just too fried to crisp wasps. and meanwhile, this fight that started with the parents is now transferred to Alex and Isabel. And they're fighting about religion and what the kid wants. And Isabel does have a bullshit argument about stopping in front of the church as being a sign the child is going to be Catholic. Like, that's bullshit. We all know it's bullshit. And I'm very proud of Alex for not really calling her out on that. But, you know, Alex is like, well, I'm Presbyterian, that's important to me too. Because she's like, you don't do anything with it. You're not very faithful. Like, why do you care now? And it's very clear he cares about it now because his parents have showed up. And that's the only reason why this has now become a thing. And then we get to this really nice moment where Alex and Isabel decides, you know, she's going to try and find some compromise with Alex. And, you know, she takes him out to the Hoover Dam for his birthday, and they talk and have this very nice quiet conversation. And she says, you know, I'm willing to give it a shot living in New York. All I ask is that we just stay here until the baby's born. Mm-hmm. And Alex is like, oh, that's perfectly fine. That's about when this project's supposed to wrap up anyway. So I can get us to October. That's perfectly fine. After that, then we can move to New York and he can have the project of his dreams. And she also like flies out grapes, papaya, hot dogs for him, yeah, which he absolutely loves. So he gets a little bit of his culture.
Yeah. I thought that was a really sweet moment.
Mm-hmm. And so after that, Alex ends up going to his job, and they're having trouble. They're having a lot of trouble with OSHA and everything. They're about to get written up for all these violations and shut down for a week. And at the time, you know, he's just sweet talked the OSHA guy into like giving them a shot to get things right when a sign falls on the OSHA guy's car, demolishing it. And so now Alex realizes that, you know, his job is in danger. He's in danger of not getting this project that he wants. So he makes a guarantee with his boss that he can get everything finished in 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And he has no time for Isabel now. Now it's nose to the grindstone. But with that caveat that he can get it done in 3 weeks, the boss also wants him back in New York by July, not October, mm-hmm, to start the new project if he does, which just means that Alex is about to go back on his word if he wants the project that he wants without talking to Isabel. Mm-hmm. And so now he's got this secret that's detrimental to his relationship. And he's buried that deep along with, he's putting his nose to the grindstone. All he's doing is working. He's barely seeing Isabel. He's barely talking to her when they're at home. He's working all nights in bed. And I think it's really funny that, you know, he's typing in bed and that's considered like almost awful. It's such, yeah, a moment in time, yeah, considering like, all of us live on our laptops in bed. It's perfectly normal now. But like in 1997, this is a faux pas. And Isabel is there, you know, just sad and trying to get to bed. And she's trying to figure out what's wrong. And she knows something's wrong, but he's not telling her. But, you know, she can't figure it out. So then she goes to the opening of the club. He gets it done in 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And he's there with his bosses and she's all glammed up with her friend and she meets his boss and his boss says, I can't wait to see you out in New York next week. And Isabel is like, what? New York?
Right.
And they just have it out, just whole big fight about, you know, him keeping stuff from her and why is he afraid to like open up to her and be open and honest with her. And so it's why did he shut her out? You know, this is something they should have been talking about. He should have made her aware of it and, you know, just to blindside her like that. And she just storms out. When Alex finally does get home, the only thing that's there is the dog, and he's really freaked out, but he gets a call from her friend saying that Isabel is in the hospital, and he rushes over, and Isabel is pissed off with him and sad and upset and tells him that she lost the baby, and she lost the baby, so they're over, and he can just go on with his life, and Alex ends up going back to New York. And, you know, he's sad and his friend accuses him of basically living like a monk. And Isabel goes on with her life. Like, she has her brothers come and move all her stuff out. She doesn't even go back to the apartment. Alex is sad and lonely again. And Isabel does what Isabel does when she's looking for purpose. She goes to stay with her great grandmother. When she goes to stay with her great-grandmother, because we get Alex's sad and lonely montage for a bit. But when she goes to go stay with her great-grandmother, we discover that Isabel is still pregnant. Mm-hmm. And her great grandmother, you know, is kind of letting Isabel have it about not being with her one true love and avoiding love and avoiding hurt and pain. And if she really wanted it, she has would have to take a chance. And Isabel is, you know, kind of being thick-headed about things, but she also hears her great grandmother at the time. But she hasn't changed her mind. She's still going to go through with getting a divorce. And the next scene we see is Alex receiving the divorce papers from Isabel, and he has 1 week to respond, or else they're divorced.
Right.
Which I don't know how divorces really work, but that seems a little rapid fire for me.
Maybe it was like some special thing. I don't know. Some
Some
special
special
rush thing.
Nevada, yeah, some special Nevada divorce, and so he's kind of melancholy about that. When who calls him? Kathy. And Kathy's like, "We're going out, you know, boating with my parents and your parents, and I just thought you'd like to come." And Alex, who has avoided Kathy his whole entire life, decides now is the time that he's going to actually take Kathy up on a date. And so he's leaving work, and that's when he bumps into this weird priest who tells him there are signs everywhere.
That's another one of my favorite scenes where, like, as Alex is going to he's going to meet her at a helicopter, what is it called? Heliport.
Helipad,
Yeah,
heliport,
helipad.
yeah.
Some whatever. He's going to meet them there, and he keeps running into all these signs of Isabel and his life in Vegas as the priest. Then, like, he sees there's a sign on the bus for Caesar's Palace in Vegas. He sees a chihuahua. This man has a chihuahua, like the dog that Isabel has. They're just like all like back to back. He sees a picture of the Grand Canyon, that looks a lot like Isabel's work. It's just really, like, I love this scene because, we already have established that he does not believe in signs. He does not believe in fate and stuff like that. But here's this moment where, like, all these memories of Isabel are coming up for him, and he can't deny that. He can't deny that.
And then he gets to the heliport and he's in the waiting room, and there's this little Latina girl who's sitting there who can't stop staring at him.
Yes.
And just as he's walking out to the helicopter with Kathy and all the family and everybody, the little girl chases after him, and her mom or whatever jumps up and goes, "Isabel." And he's just stuck. He is completely like, "No, I can't do this." And he tells Kathy that, I mean, I assume he tells Kathy that basically, fuck you, I have to go.
Right.
And the next thing we see him, he's standing in Mexico trying to figure out how to get to wherever her great grandmother lives. And he's going by bus, by burro. He's going like all the way to the back country of Mexico, and he gets to her great grandmother's house, and she tells him that Isabel has left back to Vegas, but she's talking all in Spanish, so he only thing that he catches is that she's gone to Vegas. She doesn't know that she's gone to Vegas because she needs to give birth, like she's getting close to giving birth. And he rushes back off to the airport, and he manages to get back to Vegas ahead of her. And when he does that, he decides, "I'm there in time enough to stop her at her favorite spot where she throws the coin at the Hoover Dam." And he's just standing in the middle of the fucking highway with the audacity of a white man.
Yes.
Waiting for her to come driving down the highway so that he can stop her. And as he's standing there, of course, the heavens open up and rain starts pouring down.
Yes.
And he manages to stop her just before she ran into him, mind you. And once again, almost causing a collision, but definitely a holdup of traffic on the Hoover Dam. And, you know, she gets out into the rain and they're fighting, and he's saying how he believes in signs now. And she says, well, she's given up all her faith in signs. And, you know, he's like, no, I believe in us, I believe in you. And then he gets close to her and realizes that she's pregnant still. Secret baby. And you know, he's begging her to like come back to him, and she's just like, I'm getting ready to give birth. Like, no, I'm giving birth right now, and you need to call the police. And they call somebody who comes out, and he delivers her baby there in the rain on the Hoover Dam. And in that moment, you know, as he's coaching her on, they come back together. And you know, even though they actually officially divorced, because of course it hits midnight, he didn't meet the deadline. But she agrees, you know, that she loves him too, and they have a family together now. And so it ends with them getting married once more at the Grand Canyon and kissing and happily ever after.
It's so sweet. And it's like, to go back to that, you know, we're gonna chase you down in the airport, or chase you down to the train station. They're like, no, we're gonna chase you down like across country lines, and then also like in traffic. I was just such a sucker for it. And you know, the then there's this moment of where you have to have the rain, right? Like that has to happen in any kind of romantic situation, where the rain has to be pouring down. And like, maybe it's, you know, also symbolic of like cleaning away all the past stuff, you know, like the rain comes in, because as soon as she has the baby, the rain stops, and they have this really great moment of reconnecting. And I don't know, I just love this movie. I love this movie so much.
Like, okay, I'll be honest, I'm not really a big fan of grand gestures that take place in public, because I think that they're manipulative. However, in this case, I'm cool with it, because he's doing it at a place that he knows has a lot of meaning to her. And he's showing that he believes in signs now. He believes in basically the thing that is her engine for life. And he's standing right at that place, the place where she makes her wishes. He's standing there before she can make the wish. And it's almost like her prayers being answered in a way, because he's there waiting for her at that special place for her. And so I like that, even though he almost killed people.
Yes.
I do like that bit of it. So let's talk about what do you like? What do you hate? And yeah, let's start around there.
Okay, well, let me say the things that I disliked. I could tell that they were trying to avoid race and culture stereotypes, but they still hit on kind of a lot of them, I think. And I am Black American, so I can't really speak to a Mexican and Mexican American heritage and the cultural aspects of that. But it does seem like they were just kind of like, here are the big things, right? Like big families, loud families, colorful decor, and like colorful in this case is read as tacky, at least from Alex's point of view, and like Alex and his parents' point of view, that kind of thing. And then there's the Chihuahua that's there. And you know, like in that moment when Alex comes back from falling into the bushes of cactus, or whatever, like the pile of cactus, and he comes back in, and the brothers are carrying him because he's drunk, and you know, obviously he can't walk very well because he's got all these needles in him. And he comes through the door and he says, "Lucy, you got some splaining to do," as in Desi Arnaz's character, Ricky Ricardo from I Love Lucy. And Ricky and Desi Arnaz were Cuban, and his family is Mexican. So it's just like, you can't just throw on a funny Spanish accent and that's okay. But, you know, those things, I'm just like, I wish that there had been a bit more polish in showing this Mexican American family and their differences. But what I love, I am not a grand gesture, a public grand gesture person either. Like I agree. I think they can be manipulative. And I'm also just like, I don't want everybody looking at me in this very private, personal, intimate moment between the two of us. Like that's just for us. I mean, I may share it at some point, you know, but it's still like in the moment, I want it to be us too. So that's not, I don't like that for me in real life, but on screen, I can deal with it. And I love that. I love him just going through, you know, the travel that he did to show, you know, all the things that he did to prove that he was committed to this and how willing he was to recommit to Isabel. Mm-hmm. That was my favorite thing. And I love that when he goes to see her great grandmother, even though he doesn't understand what she's saying, he recognizes that she's being kind to him and that she's being loving to him. And he just kind of absorbs it. And he's like, I'm tired, you know, but let me go on this next leg of this journey. So I really love that moment between the two of them. And there was a moment when he sees the baby in a sonogram. Like, he originally comes to her doctor's appointment because he's going to see, you know, he's like, maybe this isn't going to work out. You know, maybe there's just too much different between us. But then he hears the heartbeat, of course, and it changes his mind. Or at least it gives him like a different perspective. And I thought that Matthew Perry is just, I don't know, he has these really sweet moments, you know, that he's able to like pull in these really sweet moments and make his character seem so sweet and loving.
Yeah, he can be surprisingly very vulnerable in a lot of these moments. And like, I mean, to talk about Friends, I think that's why Chandler Bing isn't completely awful at sometimes is because of the fact that Matthew Perry is really good at like kind of just opening himself up as a character, as an actor. And you kind of just want to believe in like kind of the earnest softness that he can convey into moments. And I really do enjoy that about his portrayal in this movie. With that in mind though, because we talked about it as a movie, what about this, if it were a book, would you just like hate?
I would hate the way that he just closed her off and he kept lying by omission, right? Like lying by not telling people things about her. And like, it came across as if he were ashamed of her. And I don't necessarily know that he was ashamed of her. It was just maybe he felt embarrassed for himself. But again, that kind of, that really wasn't really clear in the movie. Like, was he ashamed of her because she is this boisterous Mexican-American woman? Or is he embarrassed that he, you know, had this mistake, this careless mistake of getting, you know, a one-night stand pregnant? Or, you know, like, it's still a little unclear to me, even though I've seen this movie so many different times.
So I think that if this was a book, though, I think that would come out a little bit clearer, though. We would have a better insight into Alex and what Alex feels and how Alex thinks. Because with that in mind, in the movie, because he's painted as this very closed-off person, very reserved person, and Isabella's kind of like the loud, boisterous one, we get to see more moments for Isabel, like relaying how she's feeling about things and what she's thinking about things, as opposed to Alex. Like, we get some of those moments, but really what's happening in those moments is it's typically he's talking to his friend, and his friend is the one doing the majority of the communicating, and Alex is kind of like reacting to that instead. I think if it was in a book, we would get more of Alex's insight. At least I would hope so. If they were writing it right, we would get more of what was going on in his head and how he was feeling, because he's such an insular person.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, because when he's talking to his friend, like you said, he's reacting because like the friend is saying stuff from like this kind of bitter, divorced man perspective. And Alex is like, dude, that's terrible. No, it's not like that. You know, he's just kind of like, he's always disputing something as opposed to claiming, like, you know, as opposed to just like saying how he feels. And, you know, there is like that moment when he goes, when Alex goes to speak to his boss, and he's like, but the baby's not due until October. And the boss is like, is that going to be a problem? And that's so indicative of the workplace and how, you know, parenthood is looked down upon if it's going to cause any kind of conflict at work and, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, it also kind of speaks to the fact that men aren't given the same kind of space to be there for their family as women are in the workplace. So I did, you know, that was a cool little moment. And you could see that Alex was He did have like a quick little battle, but he obviously went for, you know, he put his job above his family. And I think in a book, like you're saying, we would have seen more of Alex realizing that the life that he knew, you know, the life that he knew with kind of a distant family, a colder family, really wasn't what he wanted anymore. And like he would probably see himself repeating patterns from his childhood and his family. And he realizes that, you know, what Isabel and her family have is something warmer and more fulfilling. And, you know, I would have liked to have seen that worked into the movie a little bit more, but it's still, I don't know. I still, I think it's just, I don't know why I love how sweet it is. And then, you know, at the end and they get remarried on the cliffs again. Because there's when Isabel is talking to him about how she is willing to compromise and go to New York, she tells the story about these families that were a family of squirrels that were lived, you know, split by the canyon. So like the northern squirrels look like this and the southern squirrels look like that. But even though they look different because they had to adapt to their environments, they're still the same squirrel. And Alex is like, well, do they ever cross the canyon to get to each other? And you know, she's like, I don't know, but whatever. But so I like, you know, that they were trying to have this communication of what can we do to bridge the divide between us. And you know, who knows what ends up happening like after the marriage. I kind of want to know what happens. Like, I don't necessarily want a sequel, but like, I don't know, I wouldn't mind
You
having
want an
some.
epilogue.
Yeah, I need something. I would like something.
Some dialogue thrown up at the end saying they had five more kids and they're happily ever
Yes.
after in Nevada.
Yes.
Nicole, what do you have going on right now?
Right now, I am finishing up my memoir, which will be out next year in 2021. And it is called Sometimes I Trip on How Happy We Could Be, which is a line from my favorite Prince song, If I Was Your Girlfriend, from the Sign of the Times album. So I'm dealing with that. And even though we have retired Thursday Kit, I am working on another project. It's too early to talk about, but hopefully that will launch in January. Yeah, so that's kind of those are the two main things that I've got going on right now. I'm in an anthology that's currently out called A Measure of Belonging, and it is 21 writers from the South talk about the South. So it's called A Measure of Belonging. I'm in that. It's already out, and I'm working on another essay for another anthology that's going to be out next year called Sex and the Single Girl. And it is about it's a modern version of like sex and dating, you know, for the 21st century single person. So that's going to be out next year. Yeah, so
All
kind of
right.
what's going on.
Awesome. And where can people find you on the interwebs?
I am on Twitter at Tennessee Whiskey Woman. That is TN Whiskey with an E Woman. And my website is Nicole Perkins, and that is NicholePerkins.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Nicole. I really appreciate
Thank you. This is
it.
so fun.
I'm glad you had fun. So as y'all can probably figure out, we recorded this episode last year, and Nicole's new project is actually already out. It's called the This Is Good For You podcast. Episodes drop every other Friday, so be sure to check that out. Nicole's memoir, Sometimes I Trip on How Happy We Can Be, actually drops next month, August 17th. So be sure to grab a copy from your local bookstore or public library. Other than that, thanks for joining us, and see you next week. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Be sure to leave a review on the Apple Podcast Store. Also, if you'd like to follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram, you can find it under Rom Ever After on both platforms. And if you wish to just follow me for other randomness, you can catch me at Ali is Writing on both platforms as well. Until next week.